From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, after 13 years of fighting a lawsuit over the Texas troubled foster care system, state lawyers are trying to remove the judge from overseeing the case. And do you remember when a little girl fell down a well in Midland, Texas in 1987? There is much more to the story. This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. The state of Texas goes before the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals on Monday. Its lawyers want contempt fines levied by a federal court judge in Corpus Christi over failures in its foster care system struck down, and it wants that judge removed from the case. That judge, Janice Jack, called the foster care system broken in 2015, saying many kids left the system worse than when they entered it. The case stretches back more than 13 years, the product of many youth and their lawyers suing over civil rights violations. Texas Public Radio's Paul Flav sat down with one of the children who originally sued.
Alyssa Murphy's now 27 years old. She entered foster care at age 6. When Murphy decided to join the federal lawsuit over her treatment at the hands of the state, she said she'd spent time in more than 36 placements. She'd been assaulted by a staff member at a treatment center. She'd been ignored by an overwhelmed caseworker. And she especially had been over-medicated. And she was allergic to many first-generation psychotropic medications, finding out the hard way. Then, the worst part. Foster care lost 4 years of her case file, including her medical file. They put her back on the drugs she was allergic to.
So, when that happened, I developed severe tics. I had seizures. I was in the middle of school, and I would just not remember anything, but I'd wake up in my bed, and it would turn out that I was watching the teacher, and the next thing I know, I busted my head open, hitting the desk, because I just passed out. Brain blank. You know, the teacher was so worried that she was reaching out to the MSHA and to CPS and to everybody. Like, my teacher was the one who even cared. Like, she's the reason they even took me off Geodon, because nobody knew. I didn't even know it was happening to me.
By the time she escaped the system, she says she was on so many pills it would have sedated a 300-pound man.
It was so bad. I don't remember anything. When I say enough to probably sedate a grown man, by the time I was 17 years old when I ran away, I was on 200 milligrams of trazodone, 50 milligrams of Benadryl, and 3 melatonins just to go to sleep at night. That was every night. I was passing out in my dinner plate on the fireplace because that's how much it took me to sleep with all the medication that I was on during the day. Like, when my grandma used to come see me in Meadowlands, she's the only person I had steady contact with. And she would come visit me regularly. When she would come visit me, I would be dazed, drooling out of my mouth. I wouldn't be able to speak. I don't even remember her coming to see me.
Do you think that the case has made a difference for kids?
Oh, yes. That's why I still talk about it. 100%, I think. Well, not even just with those major things like over-medication. Like I told you in that little point, I never spoke to my caseworker. I never went to one court ever. I wasn't allowed to. They didn't think it was worth me putting my own input in or any of that, you know? And that has changed. Caseworkers don't have 100 kids anymore on one caseload. I believe that it's getting a lot better, slowly but surely.
Well, the state of Texas thinks it's in compliance with these court orders. It believes that it is ready to be released from this court case, or at least large portions of this judge's oversight. What is your take, if you have one, on the current state of child welfare in Texas?
I do believe that the state still has some things that they need to fix, and I do not believe they are ready to be released. I do not just for instance, I'll use something that everybody would know is the kids in the hotels. Children without placement up in hotels, just constantly being jumped to one hotel to another, to another, to another.
In terms of the filings, as you know, Texas will argue that not only should these contempt fines for these failures They want those thrown out, but they also want Judge Jack thrown out. Why do you think, or what do you think of that argument that these contempt fines should be thrown out and Judge Jack is biased, they say. You know, that's evidenced by these contempt rulings. It's evidenced by the way she has exerted herself in the case or comported herself in the case. What do you think of those arguments?
It's the law. Everybody has to abide by the law. I don't see it as biased at all. I see her reforming. I see her holding people accountable. I see her seeing a problem and wanting to fix it. That is it.
What would it mean to you if Judge Jack was taken off the case?
I think, me personally, I would be very upset. If you were to remove a judge who actually has all of the knowledge needed for a case like this, this is not a case that is something that the judge can pick up and pick up everything they need to know in a month. It's not a case they can do it in a year. This is not a case that they can do that in 2 years. Do you know what I mean? If you take Judge Jack off this case, you're going to be replacing her with somebody who potentially could be missing a lot of important factors that have already been presented before.
What is it like to listen to these cases and listen to the judge tediously extracting information from, at times, reluctant and resistant DFPS and HHSC staff? What's that like for you?
Well, personally, it's frustrating. I could not be as patient as Judge Jack. That's why I'm not a judge, though. I would be biased, but I see they make a lot of excuses. I see that they try to run away from situations before presenting evidence that they can. When I see that, it's very frustrating because I don't think that it's that hard. So I don't see why they're spending money fighting her when they could be spending money trying to get out of this lawsuit and working with her.
When you hear the numbers associated with what the state spent, you know, the state has said it has spent $150 million trying to improve the system and $60 million on the court monitors that, you know, are writing these reports, evaluating their progress, things like that. What do you think?
I do appreciate what they have spent on trying to reform, but that's them doing their job as the state. That's not a charity. It's them doing the right thing after many years of trauma that have been that was induced upon a bunch of children.
Alyssa Murphy is one of the original plaintiffs in the now 13-year-old federal case against Texas Foster Care. The Texas Department of Family and Protective Services does not comment on this federal litigation.
On October 14, 1987, 18-month-old Jessica McClure fell down an uncapped well in her aunt's backyard in Midland. What followed was 58 hours of suspense as TV viewers across the country held their breath as rescuers attempted to free the little girl, who became known as Baby Jessica. Lance Lunsford was there. He was a fourth grader and watched the whole drama, and for decades followed the story. Lunsford has written a book about it, Inside the Well, the Midland, Texas Rescue of Baby Jessica.
Really a story of, not only the rescue of a little girl who fell in a well, but the community who came together with their first responders to save her, and really how it captured the world's attention through an emerging cable news medium.
Right. If you were to explain to someone, why was this such a significant event beyond the fact that there was a little girl whose life was in jeopardy because she fell down this well in the backyard in Midland, Texas? The broader scope explanation was this was the birth of a sort of a new spectacle in America of 24-hour news coverage of something that typically wouldn't actually be national news.
Yeah, I think you have the combination of things, but you also have you have that for sure. You have the fact that you can cover wall-to-wall 24-hour news. However, what really made that stand out was that you could hear the little girl's voice. And so you have this little girl 20 feet below ground, can't be reached, but you can hear her. And the second that they dropped a television, one of the local affiliates dropped their microphone down the well and handed off the headphones to the rescuers, and you could hear that baby's voice. It became a completely different thing. And I think that was the main thing that attracted first the regional markets, DFW, and then out from there to become the international story that it became.
And you could hear her singing Winnie the Pooh.
That is exactly right. You know, in the way that we kind of capture it, you know, I would say a news hook, that really kind of personalized her, where you don't just have the image of the little girl that, you know, that the family provides to the media. You now have that voice, and now you have every single parent who has a toddler who has had a toddler that now has a personal relationship with exactly what's going on. They are incredibly invested in it from that moment, and they know what it feels like to be that mom right there that they can see standing in her backyard worried. They're this small water well casting, and it in a lot of these residential backyards that started in around the late 1960s and early 1970s, there in this part of Midland, they had these kind of we call them abandoned water wells, but they're not capped. And in this particular case, it was a well that had like a either a rock or a potted plant on it. There's been a couple of different versions of that story. And the kids, some kids that were playing in the backyard with Jessica, they knocked kind of the cover off, and they were dropping leaves and stuff down there. Yeah, she falls down that well, and the story is that they were playing back there and she slipped in.
Then the mother has to find, go looking for her. Where's baby Jessica looking around the yard? And then she realizes she fell down this well.
Yeah, and what you have is kind of an unlicensed daycare where a number of families were dropping off their kids to at this residence, and Sissy McClure was one of them that was caretaking. And again, it's an unlicensed facility that was kind of dealt with in the aftermath. At the end of the day, parents were dropping off their kids there, and these kids were playing in the backyard, Jessica among them, obviously. And when, according to Sissy, she goes inside to answer the telephone, when she comes back, Jessica's nowhere to be found. But all the little kids, all the other little kids, are kind of standing around the wellhead, and it's kind of indicated that that Jessica McClure has gone down the well for the first time. And so she starts screaming, yelling her baby's name, and Maria Petronella next door hears her screaming and runs outside to hear to find Sissy there, exclaiming like, you know, baby, my baby is falling down the well. Jessica's falling down the well, and she's yelling into it. And Miss Petronella quickly calls 911, and that's apparently the first call that goes into first responders.
What is your personal connection to the story?
So I have a personal connection, just that I was in the fourth grade living in Midland. It's the middle of the oil bust, and my actual elementary was about a mile away from where this occurred. And then my grandparents lived about four houses down. So after school, for those 3 days, we went over to my grandparents' house and watched this media grow from, you know, day one. And I remember being in that backyard and seeing Rodney Wunsch, the KMID TV, the ABC affiliate news reporter, kind of pacing back and forth. And I remember that it stuck out in my head because he was practicing kind of his lead for his stand-up in front of the camera that afternoon. He looked like a crazy person saying, you know, talking to himself. And you've got that local media response there on day one. And then we saw it daily grow and grow and grow. And I've always been, you know, fascinated since then with the media business and with first responders, and then working as a news reporter. My first job at the Midland Reporter-Telegram in 2001, got to know a lot of those guys.
So they were sending oxygen down to baby Jessica. This went on for 56 hours, 2.5 days.
Yeah, so you have a couple of issues. Now you're going into night. It's the fall of October 1987. And as you go into night, that air temperature is dropping. Now it's still West Texas, so it's not like it's a frozen tundra, but nonetheless, your body temp starts to And it has to be regulated. So they also drop, they basically shift air, warmer air down into the well so that the she can maintain her body temperature. And then oxygen is needed.
Do they send food and water?
That was the biggest thing that really made them running up against the clock is food and water. So as you near 2 p.m. on Friday, the desperation among the rescuers is, and this is really where the story hinges for our primary, the rescuer that we feature, Robert O'Donnell, who basically was told, if you can, and by, he's told by the physicians that are there on site, that we're at such a critical point in this rescue, we've got to get this child out because of dehydration, that if you have to break a limb to get her out and unwedge her from the well, do it. And when they weren't able to get her around that 2 o'clock hour, Robert O'Donnell emerged from the well kind of broken and broke down on a curb near the residence. And a lot of people that knew him, a lot of people that saw this occur, said that that was really the moment that changed him. And they saw a very different person than they had seen before he went in.
We'll get more on Robert O'Donnell's story, tragic story, in just a bit. But I want to go back to that thing you mentioned about breaking a limb. So you mean like breaking the limb of Jessica, maybe break her arm or whatever it takes to get her out of the well alive.
Right. She was wedged in this well, and they had a rescue shaft that ran parallel to the well. Then another lateral kind of diagonal tunnel was dug to reach her, and it came in just underneath where one leg was sticking down so they could grab her foot. Her other leg was wedged up by her head, and her foot was basically pressed up against her forehead. So she was lodged in. And so they basically said, if she's so lodged that the only way to really maneuver her based on however you can feel is to break either, you know, a leg or an arm, then you need to do it.
So she was kind of like doing the splits with her legs, and one, her right leg over her head. And I can imagine being in that position for so long, she almost lost that foot when she was rescued.
That's right. So she had a number of injuries, primarily from the pressure, some kind of pressure injuries from being in the well. So her forehead, and then obviously the blood flow from her foot meant that she had a couple of digits there on her foot that were removed, that were amputated, and then she had a skin graft on her part of her head.
Did people think that the mother, Sissy, did they accuse her of doing this on purpose?
On the record, no one made that kind of an allegation. I can imagine that today, given the kind of media environment that we're in, that is ironically much different today than even it was then, even as different as it was becoming then, I can imagine the kind of experience that a mom would face like Sissy today in today's media environment, given social media, given the nature of cable news not really being news anymore so much as it is expression of opinion. And then also you take the experiences that we've had since then. And, you know, you want to talk about a very dark hour in America, and that's the Susan Smith story in the Carolinas. And we didn't have that experience then. And so when some of those questions were presented, that was rejected soundly, pretty harshly, because it was such a positive story that anyone that the way it was kind of presented to me was that anyone who would present that kind of idea was sick in their own head for even imagining it.
A much more innocent time.
I think so. And I mean,
how did Midland react to this entire spectacle? At the time, it was not used to the spotlight. Here it was, relatively isolated part of Texas. I remember at the time, I was working in television news, and we were, of course, covering this through satellite, wondering how was it that Midland even had the technology at the time to be providing the 24-hour news coverage?
Yeah, interestingly, they were one of the first markets to adopt the live on-site broadcasting from the scene of incidents there in those local affiliates at KMID. But Midland, as small as it is, as West Texas as it is, literally the West Texas desert, it really is bold. Even perhaps like people might think in it from other communities, maybe they think that they're bold in their own minds. But you're talking about one of the largest oil-producing regions in the world that has, economic implications that are bigger than even the state. And then you have George H.W. Bush, who had spent two parts of the beginning of his career there in West Texas. And we're talking about George H.W. Bush, George Bush Sr., George W. Bush only being kind of a footnote in the George H.W. Bush story. But George H.W. Bush is emerging as a vice president, or is the vice president. He's been in office for 7 years, and he's emerging as the front running candidate for the 1988 election. And later on that month is readying his announcement in Houston and for a national launch into that campaign. So Midland very much saw itself as a larger than life kind of city, despite its size. But it was economically extremely dark at this time. You had the price per barrel of oil was around $13. Compare that to today, where we have $90, and we're kind of like, man, sure, nice to get it up there a little bit more. But there was no way anybody would ever imagine back then that it would get to, in 2000, in the 2000 teens, into the, $100, $115 a barrel range. But for it to drop to, 13 in 1983, and then to 1987 being, even lower, it was a really dark and desperate time for employment there in the community. So this was, we really tell that economic story because it's important to how elated the entire community felt that something so positive had occurred, something so amazing, so touched miraculously, that they were able to do this and save this little girl in such a dark, painful time. It was such an amazing feeling to have come together to accomplish this thing that seemed impossible.
So let's go back to Robert O'Donnell, who was one of the firefighters involved, directly involved with the rescue of Jessica McClure. He was heralded as a hero. How did that impact his life?
Yeah, it's so difficult when you mentioned bringing up the story to someone who had never heard of it before, of the rescue, and trying to explain that. It's even more difficult when trying to explain that someone who is heralded, as you said, as a hero, kind of falls from grace to the point that they would kill themselves. It's unimaginable. What essentially Robert kind of fell into was this place where he was held on a pedestal above. He was held on a pedestal as kind of the hero of the rescue, and so was it the other rescuer who you saw coming out of the well live on TV there that evening, and his name was Steve Forbes. But they very much at some point took different paths, and so Robert went down the path that every time someone from the media called for a follow-up interview, years, like a year, 2 years, 3 years later, he would do that. And he was still going out to take speaking engagements if someone asked him to. And at some point, Steve Forbes shied away from that because he saw the effect that that was having on the other firefighters, the other police officers that had participated in the rescue. And it was creating a wedge and a real adversarial relationship with his coworkers. And so what essentially ended up happening, though, is that as Robert continued to identify himself with the rescue, he became kind of ostracized internally within his own firefighting culture. He got the nickname Robo Donald. You have the movie RoboCop that emerged at around this time, and they were kind of the joke being that he was this robot hero of the rescue. And when he developed an addiction to pain medication, and he started shopping around prescriptions, through multiple physicians in town, carrying it around in a duffel bag. He couldn't manage his sleep. He couldn't manage his pain. And he fell into a kind of a spiral from there. And it really turns much darker when he loses his job with the Midland Fire Department, which was where he had spent his life identifying who he was as a man. You're talking about a guy who barely graduated, you're talking about a guy who did not graduate from high school, got a GED, and then found this thing as an EMT and gets his paramedics license and becomes an EMT firefighter, and really identifies with this role that he has in emergency healthcare, to the point where some of his family members said that, like, he had considered, you know, transitioning and going to medical school. You know, whether that's completely true or possible, I don't know. But, you know, he identified so much with his role that then losing that job sent him even more down a spiral.
And he eventually took his own life.
Several days after watching the Oklahoma City bombing recovery, he was watching the live coverage, and he looked at the screen and he pointed and he said, "Those guys are going to need help for a really long time." And at the moment, his mom kind of processed it as this idea that he was talking about how long that recovery would take. We know now that he was talking about the fact that a lot of those guys were going to have after effects as they dealt with the images they saw, the helplessness they would feel. And if we knew then what we know now and had a level of acceptance of mental health issues and destigmatizing of PTSD, we would have had a little bit of a better relationship with the kinds of services that first responders need.
Many people have wondered whatever happened to baby Jessica McClure.
Yeah. So Jessica McClure, you know, she married, had kids, and she largely keeps to herself. And so her dad ended up leaving the area, moved to Nashville. Sissy still lives there in the house that she bought after a couple of years after the earth. They live, well, Council Normal Life and I reached out to Sissy when we first started an initial version of this book. And around 2006, you know, she was beyond reluctant to engage and had a kind of a visceral response to the idea of answering any questions. And I can, to a large degree, understand it. If you look at the way the media kind of shifted gears in their storytelling about the McClures and the years that followed, they kind of started following this trail of rumors that emerged. And so as they followed that trail of rumors, which was, you know, that the family had all this access to this money that was donated, even though it was in a trust. And then the hyperbole would start. Well, you know, I saw him driving in a Trans Am, or the family smartly, I think, kind of put a little bit of a pause on any engagement with media, but every once in a while would do a paid interview with People Magazine.
Lance Lunsford is the author of Inside the Well: The Midland, Texas Rescue of Baby Jessica. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can email us at texasmatters@tpr.org. There are past episodes of Texas Matters on our website at tpr.org. And you can find us wherever you download cool podcasts. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.